The next case on our calendar is 03-2079, William Holland versus Tina Clary et al. Mr. Freeze.
May it please the court, I'm Stephen Freeze on behalf of Appellant Twin City Fire Insurance Company. I would begin, please, by thanking all of you for allowing my traffic jam not to prevent me from arguing here today. We're very grateful for that. And I would like to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal, if I may, Your Honor.
Much your time there.
Twin City is here to seek reversal of a decision by the appellate court in Montgomery County that declared that a offer and rejection, which we believe was in accordance with HB 261 and in accordance with the Kemper case, was not a valid rejection or valid offer. Although extrinsic evidence was presented that clearly established the intent of the parties, that is the insurer, Twin City, and its insured American Ambulette, that there was no intention to, and in fact, the parties intended there be no UM coverage under the policy issued to American Ambulette, the Court of Appeals determined that such extrinsic evidence that was presented by way of an affidavit, in addition to the two rejection forms, was not admissible, and as a result, the elements of LINCO had not been met by the offer and rejection before that court. Specifically, there was no mention of premium in the offer or rejection form, and as a result, the Court of Appeals of Montgomery County determined that the rejection and the offer were invalid under LINCO, and under the Kemper case, decided that coverage arose by operation of law under the policy issued to American Ambulette. Although both the insurer and the insured clearly intended to not have UM coverage under this policy, and although evidence of that was unrebutted and was clear, the court nevertheless, on the basis of its determination of what Kemper said, decided that the rejection and the offer were not consistent with HB 261 because extrinsic evidence was not permissible. Giving rise to these issues was a car accident that occurred on October 15 of 1999 involving William Holland, the plaintiff, and a tortfeasor by the name of Davidson. A UM claim was filed against Twin City following that accident, and the policy became an issue before the court. The policy clearly showed that there was no intention to have UM coverage under this policy. American Ambulette did not want to pay a premium for that policy. Twin City was willing to honor the request that there be no UM coverage under this policy. And the intention of the parties was clear before the trial court and also before the Court of Appeals. However, given the Court of Appeals' interpretation of Kemper, the party's intent was disregarded and the coverage was deemed to have arisen by operation of law. Important in this context is the fact that the parties to the contract are Twin City, the insurer, and American Ambulette, the insured. However, the party making claim here is not either one of those. It's the plaintiff, William Holland, who is not a contracting party. And here we have the Court of Appeals elevating the intention of a non-party to the contract over and above that of the actual parties to that contract. We seek reversal because HB 261 version of the UM statute, because Kemper, and also because this court's most recent decision in Gladys militate in favor of our position and should result in a reversal of this case. Dealing first of all with HB 261, as this court is well aware, it was the version of the UM statute that became effective September 3, 1997, and it established new requirements for dealing with the issue of offer and rejection regarding UM coverage. And specifically, HB 261, by its terms, expressly stated that a presumption of a valid offer exists if there is a written signed rejection presented to the court. And in this particular case, not only one, but two signed rejections by the secretary of American Ambulette were presented to the court. There is no requirement under HB 261 that the offer be in writing. The statute is clear that the rejection needs to be signed and in writing, but there is no such requirement pertaining to what the offer need be in terms of writing or unwritten. And as noted, HB 261 set up new rules, a new scheme for judging the issues of offer and rejection. And it was different than the situation with SB 20, the previous statute, with which this court dealt in the Linco case. So we have a new statute, new requirements, and a new scheme of things to deal with this issue, none of which required that the offer be in writing or that there be any specific elements of an offer before this court can approve that offer and rejection. However, we are aware that in Kemper, this court did clearly declare that the Linco requirements, that is the three-part test, does apply to rejections even under and offers under HB 261. But the issue of extrinsic evidence was left, at least in the mind of Twin City, with some uncertainty and lacking clarification. We submit that even if Linco does apply under HB 261, that only its requirements apply, and that extrinsic evidence was not an issue dealt with in the Kemper case, except insofar as question number two, which was not the Linco question, but question two dealt with the issue of extrinsic evidence. HB 261, we submit, allows for the extrinsic evidence that was submitted to both the trial court and to the Court of Appeals in this case, and did establish clearly that the intention of the parties and the actual acts of the parties was to reject UM coverage. Dealing with Kemper next, we submit that Kemper, by its terms, in the answer to the second question, which was a single word answer, does allow for and does provide for the use of extrinsic evidence to establish a valid offer and a valid rejection. The uncertainty that this case engendered, however, by the one word answer is clear, as courts of appeals throughout Ohio have found themselves not only in conflict with other districts, but have also found themselves internally conflicted. There are at least four districts within which different panels of judges in that district have competing and conflicting decisions. Perhaps the most conflicted may be the Second District Court of Appeals, from which this case emerges. When Kemper was first decided, the first attempt by the Second District to deal with that issue resulted in the Manalo case, where the court specifically determined that extrinsic evidence was admissible in light of Kemper and also in light of HB 261. And the court in the Second District left no doubt but that the clear intent of Kemper was to allow for extrinsic evidence to be used. However, the Second District, in this very case, Holland versus Clary, withdrew from that position and reversed its own Manalo decision, finding that extrinsic evidence was not admissible. And given that situation, reversed the trial court opinion here, which had found the rejection and the offer to be valid under HB 261 and also under Kemper. The Holland case was then followed by another decision out of the Second District in which it determined that the Manalo decision is a well-reasoned opinion. In other words, they have not rejected that reasoning, but they found that since we had already reversed ourselves once, we weren't going to do it again, and so we'll stick with the decision we issued in the Holland case, which is, of course, why we are here today. We submit that the reasonable and the only proper way to properly interpret the Kemper decision is to allow extrinsic evidence in situations such as these. The language used in answering question number two is the following. The question posed, does the signed rejection under HB 261 act to effectively decline UM-UIM coverage, and quoting, where there is no other evidence, oral or documentary, of an offer of coverage? Those words, where there is no other such evidence, suggest, and I think properly conclude, that extrinsic evidence is admissible on that issue and should be conceded. Even the Second District in this very case, in its appellate opinion, said that they acknowledge that the question is posed in Kemper, the second question, intimates that extrinsic evidence could be used in the determination of whether a rejection was valid. That's the very court that has now decided the contrary. Kemper, in conjunction with HB 261, we submit, both allow for extrinsic evidence. In other words, there is no specific prohibition, either HB 261 by its terms, that prevent the introduction of extrinsic evidence on this issue, nor does Kemper prohibit such evidence. In fact, we submit that Kemper does, in fact, provide for the admission of extrinsic evidence in this situation. While the courts of appeal in this state have now probably against our position, clearly outnumber the ones who might support our position. We submit, however, that none of those courts of appeals has given any kind of compelling reason as to why extrinsic evidence should not be admissible here. We submit to the contrary, there is a compelling reason why extrinsic evidence should be admitted, and that's because the intent of the parties should be foremost before this court. In fact, this court used those words when it decided Gladys, when it said the intent of the parties is paramount. The intent here is undeniable. There's been no rebutting evidence from anyone. Plaintiffs don't even suggest, or plaintiff did not even suggest, that this was not the intention of the parties. They simply relied upon this technical LINCO requirement where premium information was not provided to justify the imposition of UM coverage on a policy where it should not be imposed, given the intent of the parties. In fact, the ironic thing here is that American Ambulette did not want to pay a premium for this insurance coverage. In retrospect, it may. If these claims are allowed to stand, they probably will have an increased premium next time around for this very claim. Maybe that's true, maybe that's not, but that is a concern and certainly runs counter to the intentions of the parties. This court in Gladys said that when the court is confronted with an issue of contractual interpretation, the role of this court is to give effect to the intent of the parties. We submit that the intention here is clear. There should be no UM coverage. That was the offer issue. That was the rejection issue, both of which the parties agree upon. Again, the plaintiff is not even a party to this contract. We submit that the role of this court, in conjunction with the legislature's role, is to interpret HB 261 as it was written, to give it a fair interpretation as it is written, and to have that accord with the intentions of the parties, which we submit are paramount here. HB 261, Kemper and Gladys all work together. There's no need to undo, overrule, or suggest any other changes be made in these decisions. They combine, we believe, to give us a unified picture of what should happen here, and that is to recognize the intent of the parties, recognize the documents and the extrinsic evidence that should have been submitted, that was submitted to the court for its attention. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Fries. Mr. Ignazi.
May it please the court, opposing counsel. My name is Ken Ignazi. I represent William Holland, who was involved in a motor vehicle accident. He was driving a vehicle that was insured by Twin City. There's no question on that. He's insured. He's entitled to benefits under the policy. This case is one of yet many cases in the past several years involving uninsured motorist coverage. I suggest, believe at this point in reviewing all of the law, that perhaps the jurisdiction has been improvidently granted in this case. For a number of reasons. First, when we look at the case, is this a case of great public interest? I submit that it has little, if any, public interest whatsoever. We all know that Senate Bill 97 became effective on October 31st, 2001, 3 years ago, and none of this can ever happen again. The legislature stepped in, and what public interest do we have in this case? There's virtually no courts that are clogging the court system except for this one that I'm aware of. Other reasons are if you look at the Second District Court of Appeals decision, There was a motion to certify a conflict. The Second District Court of Appeals went through all of the case law and determined that there was no conflict that exists. We have 9 appellate districts out of 12 holding that the offer must be in writing, as this court has done many times, contrary to the assertion of the appellant. But 9 appellate districts that say extrinsic evidence is not permitted. We also, in addition to that, we have the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals in the Roberts case saying that extrinsic evidence is not submitted. Given the status of this issue, and in the past 3 years, it cannot happen now, and in the past 3 years, and it cannot happen in the future, not to mention 9 appellate districts out of 12 in the state, plus the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals, the appellee would submit that perhaps the case was improvidently granted jurisdiction. With respect to the issues in this case, we first have the rejection issue. This has been in the court system for, I believe, over 34 years now. The courts have said time and time again, both this courts and courts of appeals throughout the state, that the offer must be in writing. The Giori and the Linko case are the two most influential cases recently. Giori stands for the proposition that we cannot know whether an insured has made an express knowing rejection of UIM coverage unless there is a written offer and a written rejection. It only follows that a valid rejection requires a meaningful offer, i.e., an offer that is in substance and not just in name. The court in the year 2000 came down with the Linko decision and explained exactly what that written offer had to be and set forth the requirements. This court in Linko said that this type of written requirement that is required, and this was after House Bill 261 became effective in 97, this type of written offer that's required will prevent needless litigation about whether the insurance company offered UM coverage. This case all results, I think, from the Manalo case in the Second District Court of Appeals. If the court recalls, I believe, the Kemper case, which was a certified question from the federal courts asking whether or not Linko applied to post House Bill 261, post 97 policies. And the decision came out on December 24th, 2002. The Manalo case in the Second District was actually my case. I did oral argument on December 30th, 2002. And I remember going into the oral argument, and I just had, you know, it was Christmas and all, and I just had the facts, the four questions there. And we argued in the Court of Appeals, and obviously we all know that a lot of the Courts of Appeals had some disdain for the Ponzer type of cases throughout the state, which this is not one of. But it was nevertheless a Ponzer type case because it was the employer's policy. And I can recall going through that oral argument, and we didn't even, all I had was the fax copy that I handed the judge that I'd just gotten the day before, because I wanted to notify the court of this court's ruling. And in that case, we did an oral argument, we didn't brief, and I was shocked when I got the opinion in February. The Second District Court of Appeals obviously reversed its position in Manalo because the majority of all the courts of appeals in Ohio have found that extrinsic evidence is not part of looking at the four corners of the contract to determine whether or not there's a valid rejection. And I think most telling in this case is that the Second District Court of Appeals has had 3 occasions to revisit this issue since this case last October. And on 3 separate occasions, most notably discussed and analyzed by Judge Wolf in the Second District Court of Appeals in the Borger case. The Borger case was decided in July of 2004, and that was supplemented by the appellee in the court's record. Now, on 3 separate occasions, it had an opportunity to address this issue again and reaffirmed each one. Judge Wolf's opinion went through all of the cases, including the Roberts case. And Judge Wolf said, after analyzing everything in 11 pages, we therefore conclude that any insurer may not use extrinsic evidence to demonstrate compliance with Linko, nor may policy language cure a defective offer of UM-UIM coverage even if the parties intended for the insured's rejection to be effective. And that's a compilation of everything as of July of 2004, even the three occasions in which the Second District had to revisit this very case and this very decision that we're talking about. I think part of the confusion in this issue and part of the reason why we're here is the Kemper decision, because the way it came to the court on a certified question as opposed to on the merits with an opinion, as you would expect on the merits. In this case, there was a rhetorical question about with or without extrinsic evidence. And so far, at this point in time, 9 courts of appeals have read it and said that based on the rulings and holdings, extrinsic evidence cannot be used. We have the Sixth Circuit in the Roberts case saying that we are unable to draw any inference from the one-word answer in Kemper that these two courts have drawn. Nothing in the Ohio Supreme Court's answer suggests that intrinsic evidence can be used to support a signed rejection. The only basis in Kemper for inferring that extrinsic evidence could be used comes from the question, a rhetorical question, I believe, that was submitted by the federal court. In this case, when you look at the overwhelming support, all of the different court of appeals opinions, quite simply, extrinsic evidence is not permitted. I think perhaps, too, we analyze this a little bit different than we did Linko or Giori. And the reason why is House Bill 261. If you look at the language in that 97 UM statute, it has things backwards a little bit. It talks about this presumption. It says that the signed rejection is a presumption. Well, before the statute had it the other way with the offer and then the rejection. Here in House Bill 261, it's written where if there's a signed rejection, then it's presumed to be valid. That's a presumption of law. A presumption of law is a rule of law that courts and judges shall draw a particular inference from a particular fact or from particular evidence unless and until the truth of such inference is disproved. Black's Law Dictionary. And there's a big difference between a presumption of fact and a presumption of law. And I think the UM statute, the House Bill 261 in 97, it has a presumption of law. We already know from this court's prior rulings in Linko, Giori, and many others that there must be a written offer. So if you have a signed rejection and it's signed, well, it's presumed to be valid. So what do you look at? Well, we know from this court's prior opinions, you look at the four corners of the contract. You don't look outside. But you look and see whether or not that rejection has all the Linko requirements. Does it have the premium stated? Does it have the brief description? Does it have statements with the limits being equal to the liability coverage? Does it have all that stuff? Did the insured even sign it? And we look at that, and if he didn't, clearly there is UM coverage provided by operation of law, which has been held by this court on many occasions throughout the years. The bottom line is, when you look at this case, intent doesn't matter. That's why this court held in Linko and several other cases that you look at whether or not they offered it. It's either there or it's not, so as to prevent needless litigation.
When you look at this, do both parties agree that the Linko requirement is not met?
Yes, I believe so. There's no question about that.
So this all turns on an argument, a statute that was enacted before Linko, right?
Correct.
But was not in the Linko case?
Correct. And we're all basing our arguments and everything that Linko does apply to post-1997 policies based on this court's decision in Kemper.
Right. So Kemper is what it's all down to, the one-word answer.
Correct. That's what I think brings us here today. And when you look at, let's just say hypothetically, you could consider extrinsic evidence outside of the four corners of the policy, which I don't think you can do, but let's assume we do that. We have the affidavit in the record. The affidavit does not set forth any specific amounts of premium. I don't believe, based on the record, even if you could do that, that the LINCO compliance and the requirements would be met in any event. There are no numbers in that affidavit about any premiums. So even if you considered that, I don't think we got LINCO compliance anyway.
So that I understand your take on the company's argument, it is that the LINCO requirements don't apply to the newer statute. Is
Senate
that right?
Bill 97, October 2001 forward, correct?
No. I mean to the statute that's in play here.
I believe that LINCO does apply to the statute, the 1997 version.
But he doesn't think so.
I'm not sure, Your Honor.
Okay. The Court of Appeals says Twin City argues that LINCO requirements are met when the offer and rejection forms are considered in conjunction with the affidavit of Miller.
Right.
So the Court of Appeals at least thought that their argument was that if LINCO does apply, LINCO is met. The test
right.
of LINCO is met.
And I don't believe that to be the case if you look at the affidavit. There are no numbers, there are no dollar signs, there are no stated premiums in the affidavit. And that's hypothetically, because I don't believe, first of all, that you can't get to extrinsic evidence. In sum, it is our position that the appeal was improvidently granted. We have 9 appellate districts out of 12, plus the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals, which is aptly summarized and analyzed by Judge Wolf in the Borger decision in July of 2004, that clearly holds that offers must be in writing, that when you have a valid rejection with a presumption, you've got to look at the offer to see if it meets the requirements. And the offer in this case in the four corners of the policy clearly did not. And when you look at this case, there is simply no reason for us to be here today. The court has said time and time again, we know all these UM cases, they're all over the place. In the past years they have. But that's why Giori and LINCO tried to set things straight. It's there or it's not. And on behalf of the appellee, we would submit that it be appropriate for the court to dismiss the appeal as being improvidently granted or to affirm the Court of Appeals. I don't believe there's any public interest that is supported by having this case being accepted and reviewed by the court for an opinion for the primary reason that for the past 3 years, none of this can happen. There's no chance of any increased premiums or anything. I mean, in the past 3 years and in the future, this issue is moot and it's dead.
Thank you, Mr. Ignazi.
Thank you.
Mr. Fries, you've saved just almost 2 minutes of your time.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Fries, did I misunderstand your argument? I thought your argument was we should be able to use extrinsic evidence, and if we do—
That's correct, Your Honor.
And if we do, you want to blank out the one requirement of LINCO and say the intention of the party show they meant not to have this coverage, and the LINCO requirement that it specify the amount of insurance and the premium to be charged for that coverage
would not
obtain.
I'm sorry, Your Honor, we're not arguing against the LINCO requirements. We understand that by the answer to by this court to the first question, the LINCO requirements apply. The question is whether or not they can be established by extrinsic evidence, and our position is yes, they can. Now, we believe HB 261 allows for that. We believe Kemper, by its terms, allows for that, and we believe Gladys requires that.
And the extrinsic evidence of the amount.
Extrinsic
coverage.
Evidence that premiums, the only element missing here was the premiums were not in the offer or rejection before the court. We
so
supplied that information.
That would seem to me to be one of the requirements of LINCO isn't met, even if you get to the extreme.
Your Honor,
that's what I'm trying to hone in on.
And all we're saying is that we should be entitled to present that evidence to the court by way of extrinsic evidence. The premium information, which we've done in the affidavit, which was before the court, and which the appellate court chose to disregard because of its interpretation of Kemper. But to show you where we've gotten to at this point, he said in his oral argument, intent doesn't matter. If that's the position of this court, then we should all go home, because that's exactly the opposite of what this court said in Gladys. Intent does matter. He also mentioned that the majority of the courts of appeals have ruled against us. Well, the court was faced with the same situation in the Davidson case when Justice Sweeney straightened out the issue of homeowners coverage not being uninsured motorist coverage. I think the list then was about 10 to 1 in favor of plaintiffs or claimants and against the insurance companies. And this court was willing at that time, like it should be now, to harmonize and let everyone understand that intent of parties does matter.
Counsel, would you address your opposing counsel's contention that this really is some situation that will not arise again, that it is peculiar only to your party's interest and is not of great general import?
Okay. Well, Your Honor, this court has already determined that it was, but in response to your question.
Well, we've been known to change our mind later.
I know,
so
I understand that.
Let me hear.
This case is governed by Ross versus Farmers. That is the law in effect at the time of the contracting as the law applies. This particular type of claim has a 15-year statute of limitations. And so we could potentially have claims down the road for 15 years. And that alone is enough to keep this issue before us. While he suggests that the claims are dwindling, we have three other appeals in courts of appeals that are following this and right into this court, just from our office in the last 2 or 3 months. This is not a dead issue. This is an issue that needs to be dealt with and understood by all the parties, both on both sides of the issue, so that justice can be accorded to that vast amount of people who do fall within that time frame. I'm not saying that we haven't changed the law to erase those claims we have down the road. But the point is, we have a number of claims that still fit within that period of time when HB 261 was still the law, and all the claimants who may fall within that category. And I'm sure this court may be more aware than I of the number of claims that are following this one and have been accepted for appeal purposes.
You've used your time, Mr. Freese.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you.